Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello one and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddow, and how brilliant that you've chosen us for your listening pleasure today. We hope you enjoy. And how could you not when we're in such brilliant company? My first guest won the Women's Prize for Fiction in 2018 for her novel Home Fire, which was also longlisted for the Booker Prize. She's the author of seven novels, which include Burnt Shadow and A God in Every Stone, and her work has been translated into 25 languages. She's a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, don't you know, and a professor of creative writing at the University of Manchester. Here to tell us about her new novel, Best of Friends, it's Kamala Shamsie. Hello, welcome to you.
Hello, thank you very much.
Lovely to see you again. And my second guest won the Commonwealth Writers' Prize for her first novel, A Golden Age, which went on to be translated into 27 languages. Her other books include The Good Muslim and The Bones of Grace, and she has been named one of Granta's Best of Young Novelists. Is that even a thing? She too is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, so we really are in great esteemed company here. And here to tell us about her latest novel, The Startup Wife, Tamima Annan, welcome to you.
Hi, it's great to be here.
And I don't really need to do introductions here, do I? Because you're like old mates.
Not that old.
I mean, young mates.
The matiness is old, but we're not that old, surely. Yeah, we are old mates.
I started out being a fangirl. Kamala's, you know, I
this is another way of saying she's younger than I am.
No, I'm really not. I'm really not. Maybe by a few months. Yeah. But so I was her fan, and then we made that awkward transition into friendship. And here we are.
No, there was a step you missed out. You read my books, then we met. Then I read her first novel, and then I became a fangirl, and then we became
friends.
Then
you became friends. Okay.
So we became friends on sort of, you know, mutual equal admiration ground.
Yes. It would have been awkward if we had sort of taken one step into friendship and then you absolutely loathed my book and thought it was the worst thing you'd ever read. And that would have just ended there.
No, I would have lied because I liked you.
But it would have been like a 15-year lie.
It's true. It's true. I have to just keep going with it.
More novels, more lies.
Yeah, endless.
And I said to you both before we started recording that I love it when I have two friends on the podcast, because when it comes to the book off at the end, the competitive streak often comes out, or is completely goes the other way. And actually, it's like, oh, no, you. And, you know, so we'll see which way it goes later between you two when we do the book off.
Well, we'll see.
But before then, of course, we're going to talk about your two new brilliant novels. We're going to talk about your writing. We're going to have some book recommendations as well of what you've been reading and enjoying recently, if indeed you've found time. Kamala, if I could talk about Best of Friends, which is just out, in fact.
Yes, I hope you might talk about it.
Yes, well, yes. That would be good, wouldn't it? Considering it's, you know, it's just published and you're here. In a recent interview that I read, you said you write novels in the most selfish way. And I love this because you said you write what you want to write. So how long after Home Fire did it take to come up with this idea?
So the odd thing about an idea for a novel is sometimes you first, you know, the origin point may be very long ago, except you didn't know it was an origin point to write the book. So in my case, it was ages and ages ago when I was in my 20s. My sister and I were having this conversation, and she said, and she has no memory of this, but I do. She said, well, the friends we make as adults are our friends because we have something in common. But our childhood friends are our friends because they've always been our friends.
Yeah.
And in my 20s, I thought this was quite interesting. But the older I've got, the more that's felt really, really true. And you know, you become friends with your childhood friends in some cases almost before you know your own character or what you think of the world or anything. It's just, you know, oh, that person was nice. We played hopscotch together. She helped me tie my shoelace. You know, and that is the basis of a friendship that can last a lifetime. But what can also happen is you become, as you grow older, you can become very, very different people. And I'd been interested for a while in this idea of these two friends who become very different people. I think when I first had an inkling that maybe there's a novel somewhere, was in 2016. So I had finished writing Home Fire, but it hadn't yet come out.
Yeah.
And between Brexit on one side of the Atlantic and Trump on the other side, you were hearing a lot of conversations where people were saying, I can no longer speak to this relative, this friend, this person who I've known forever. We've always known we have differences, but now, you know, this is it. It's the tipping point. We can't pretend they don't matter. And that old conversation, that comment of my sister's came to mind. And I thought, I'm going to have these two girls who really are the best of friends from childhood. And there comes a point where they really can no longer sort of tiptoe around the fissures in the relationship. They kind of have to do a deep dive in.
Mm.
So that, 2016 was where the first inkling happened. I didn't start writing till 2019.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And do you have a sort of best friend from the early, early years? I do. I've got a friend I've known since I was four.
Yeah. Demima actually knows, and we're both very close to, there's a friend of mine who I've known really since the day she was born, but I actually don't even think of her in that category because we're more sibling-like. Our parents were very close. We went on family holidays together. But my best friend from school, from the age of four, still very much one of my close friends. He's a boy, so it's a slightly different dynamic to the one in the book, but he's reading the book right now. You know,
oh, really?
And just texted me to say, oh, my God, I'm so filled with nostalgia and saying, I recognize this. And is that based on... And he's right about everything.
He's getting it all. Yes. Do you have the best, oldest friend?
No, I've brutally left all of my childhood friends behind.
Just cut them off.
I just really... In fact, one of the great things about Kamala is that she is really good at being a friend. She's like an amazing friend. In fact... The other day, we were having dinner together with this other friend of ours who she's known since childhood, and I had gotten into a taxi to go home, and they were standing on the curb, and someone on a motorcycle drove onto the curb, and her instinct was to stand in front of her friend and kind of shield her, and we were on this... texting each other afterwards. She said, would you believe the first thing she did was stand between me and this guy in a helmet? And I thought, yeah, that sounds just like her.
This is a totally dramatized situation. I mean, I just shoved this person, which is, I think, it's not a great friendship. Anyone with a degree of humanity would say, oh, a motorbike's coming towards you. Let me just push you out the way.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's instinct. It's clearly so hardwired into you.
Yeah. And now, for some reason, I don't know why, I've got this scene from Friends where Ross Joey dives across Ross to save his sandwich, but he thinks it's for him. I don't know why that suddenly came to mind.
An iconic saving of friends scene. Yes.
An iconic scene where it could. I mean, if I really had to, and if someone challenged me to, I could probably think of a friend's example for anything that was discussed.
I can do that with Seinfeld.
And I could maybe... Oh, yep, yeah.
You see. We're going to have a Seinfeld friend off at one point. We'll have another episode.
We might have to have an offshoot podcast with Seinfeld.
I want to know how old Themima's oldest friend is. I mean, is it dating back to university or past that?
I mean, I still have friends from childhood, but not like you do.
All right, but
you know
do,
that
they're
we're
there.
Sort of vaguely in touch. Yeah. But I feel like the friendships that I didn't learn how to be a friend until maybe 10 years ago.
Mm.
And when I had children, I think. And then I decided, you know what, my girlfriends, sorry, but this is female friendship. These are the people that are going to get me through the next various phases of my life. And it has proven to be true. I'll give you another example. And this is really going to sound like TMI, but I'm going to go there.
I'm very worried about what's happening.
Oh, don't worry. It's not you.
No, I know what's coming. She knows. I'm wondering, should I say, are you sure? This will be on air forever.
I was about to have a baby under very medically tricky circumstances. And let's just say that she showed up for some of the less glamorous parts of it.
Understood.
See, now you made me pull it back.
No, say it.
Say it. No,
because now it sounds as though I was there for the birth. I was not there for the birth.
No.
I think you can say it.
I had to get an injection.
Right.
In my butt.
Yes.
You know, yeah. And she mm-hmm. was there for
and
that.
She was there.
Yes, yeah. She was.
A friend in need. You know,
there you go.
Yeah. So just to come back to these two friends then and the book, the novel is set between late 80s Karachi and present day London. Mm. Would you just, I know you've alluded to it, but just set up the story for us, for the listeners who haven't got to this book yet.
Sure. So the novel starts in 1988 and our two friends, Zara and Mariam, are already 10 years into a friendship. They're 14 years old. And it's a moment of change, both sort of internally and externally. So they're changing because they're coming into adolescence and sexuality and hormones and new relationship to how men are looking at them, and they're looking at boys and looking at how the boys are looking at each other, and at, you know, all of this stuff is happening. And out in the world, they've been living almost all their whole lives under military dictatorship, and this is based on actual, you know, Pakistani history.
Yep.
And in August of that year, he dies, and suddenly there's all this talk of democracy and elections, and not just democracy and elections, but that there's going to be a woman in charge. And they, you know, they don't believe it at first, this possibility. And the novel, that first section ends basically when Benazir Bhutto, 35-year-old woman, has just been inaugurated, and both of them feel anything is possible for a girl. And it gives them this sort of mood of recklessness, and then they do something. Something happens. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, has that potential to be either really risky or pleasurable. And it sort of casts a shadow over the next 30 years.
And I want to come back and talk about another central theme in this book in a moment, which I took from it personally. And I wondered, you know, if this was something that you built the story around. But we'll come back to that, because Tamira, I want to talk about the startup wife. I want to talk about Asher and Cyrus. I wonder if you could set this book up for those that might not have got to it yet.
Sure. It's a novel about a girl who develops a world-changing app, but because of her own ingrained imposter syndrome, or because of the world and patriarchy and the structures of power as we know them, it turns out that her childhood sweetheart and her husband ends up getting all the credit for it. And so it's about power in the marriage, but also power in the larger sense of the word and how she sort of claims it back.
And your husband has invented a app, right? Or a tech?
My husband is a tech CEO. Yeah.
Tech CEO, yeah. Right. Yeah. So I'm thinking now, that happened. You sit on the board of that company. That's when the idea must have come to you. Or is that not the case?
I mean, absolutely. It was my first time being in a sort of work environment, you know, because I'd been a writer and an academic. I had no idea what office politics looked like. And it was really shocking to me how unreformed office culture is and how deeply biased it still remains.
Yeah.
Something that we spend most of our waking hours doing, and yet doesn't really match kind of the ideas that we have about ourselves and about equality. So I would, you know, not that I was in a toxic workplace. Yeah. I was just noticing the hierarchies and the ways in which people were gendered, and the jokes that people told.
Yeah.
So for me, I was sitting there in these board meetings thinking, gosh, I have to write this novel. And I didn't, and it doesn't mirror reality in the sense that I didn't invent the tech that, you know, my husband is the company that my husband is now the CEO of at all. But I thought, what if it was me?
Mm.
How would I be treated if I was the visionary and I was the inventor? Would I be given the same kinds of privileges?
Because, of course, in your book, the husband becomes the CEO, right?
Yes.
And that in itself is like, well, in this male-led tech world, that's almost just like, well, that's what you do, isn't it? You put a male figurehead at the front
exactly.
of this company.
And it wasn't even his idea.
Yeah.
She kind of pushes him to do it.
Yeah.
No, I mean, not just the app, but making him the CEO. So it's a kind of, you know, she doesn't even realize that she's giving something away because these kinds of things are so internalized for us.
And in The Best of Friends, one of the themes, I think quite a central theme of the book, is this feeling of vulnerability, especially around specifically with being a woman, which you've sort of mentioned. And you also look at the power of women, or the lack of power for women as well. Was it this idea that made you write the story around it? Or did you sort of weave that into the plot as you were writing it?
I mean, I'm a make it up as you go along kind of writer for the early draft. I think the thing that both Temima's book and mine are sort of interested in is the relationship of women to power, when power has been so, you know, masculine and patriarchal. Hers is also very funny. I mean, it's a brilliant satire as well of that world. But it's sort of, I think in some way, you know, when you, I mean, quite early on, I knew that that section was going to end with Benazir becoming prime minister. And I also know that that didn't go so well for her, and, you know, ends with her assassination. And I think it's sort of, you know, I was sort of looking at the girls looking at that and their awareness that this is the one woman in a world of men power. And I did, at a reasonably early stage, I thought, actually, I want them both to be powerful. I think at one point I thought maybe one will be and the other. And I thought, no, I want them both, and to see the different ways, and in some ways not so different ways, that they are responding to this idea of power and how you're relating to the establishment who has the most power.
And you mentioned your friend who's reading it at the moment that you've known since you were four. So how much he's getting a lot right when he's texting you. Yeah. How much were you consciously building their friendship on friendships that you've had over the years?
Not particularly, you know, and maybe it is because I, you know, in that moment of adolescence, my closest friend was a boy. And so it was just very, and in fact, if anything, it became the space where there was a little distance between us, because it was clear we were having different experiences of things, and we weren't really talking about them. But I'm not sure. I mean, of course, I did have female friends as well. And I don't know about you, Temima, but certainly the way we talk now about being women and being in our bodies and things like that. At 14, you just didn't, even though it was very obvious that all these things were suddenly happening to everyone around you. So I think some of that comes in is that they're very, very close. They talk to each other about everything. But once their sexuality starts emerging, there are these sort of secrets that come in, these silences that start entering the friendship really for the first time.
I thought you did that so beautifully. I thought you captured that intimacy, but that growing sense of like there are these shadows and there are these unspoken things. So it was so true. I remember being that age, and I was sort of pulled back into that sense of mystery about myself and others, and not really knowing, and having this kind of, I don't know if women, young women these days have that experience, because so many things that used to be unsaid are now said or seen. But certainly when I was growing up, I remember that sense of, you know, having these intense relationships and yet feeling that there were things that couldn't be said, almost like I couldn't even say them to myself.
I felt exactly the same reading it, and as thinking back to being a teenage boy as well, and just thinking, whatever's happening to me can only be happening to me, and no one would understand, and I can't possibly say anything about it, you know. And that must just have been the case for everyone, right? Any 14, 15 year old going through that. I just wondered something that you said earlier to me about, I think you said sort of some of the language around, you know, businesses and tech and boardrooms. And very recently, I've read a book by Pragya Agarwal called Hysterical. I don't know if you know this book, which is published by Canongate. And she looks at the gendering of emotions. And I just found it absolutely fascinating, and also quite sort of awful as well in how we haven't necessarily moved on from the Greeks. I just wondered if you knew of it, and you're nodding, which means that you possibly know of it because of being published by Canongate.
Yes, I've had conversations about the book, but I haven't read it myself. I do think that the thing that is so surprising is that we inherit these kinds of stereotypes about genders that we don't even know we've inherited. And then when you go back and unpack the sort of myths, it can be really shocking. The way that people talk about women's bodies in the workplace. So I was at a meeting just the other day, actually, and there was somebody who was trying to plug in a piece of tech, and he was kind of having trouble doing it. And then somebody else stepped in, and they're like, oh, no, he should finish what he started. He's already pregnant. Does that make any sense to you in any way, shape, or form? Basically, it's a thing that people say when they say you've already taken so many steps into something, you might as well finish. He's already pregnant. He might as well have the baby.
No, I've never heard that before.
Yes, but it's the third or fourth time I've heard that said in a very kind of funny. And then in that moment, I never know whether to say, man, that was really effed up.
Yeah,
you can't talk like that.
Yeah.
Or just to be like, funny, you know, kind of awkwardly laughing along. And there's a kind of social expectation that you will tolerate a kind of language that is deeply demeaning and really gestures towards the lack of reform in this very important part of our lives.
Well, and even where people think they're attempting reform, so there might have been a time where a woman with strong views was described as strident. So now a lot of people recognize we shouldn't say strident, but instead they'll say, and this is meant as a compliment, fierce. She's fierce. Mm-hmm. But when are men fierce? You know, men have strong opinions.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, so, you know, yes, we're very glad we're not strident anymore, but why do we have to be fierce?
Why do we have to be fierce?
For God's sake. You know?
And in this book, if you do get to it, and I would recommend it to anyone listening and to both of you as well, it Pragya looks at quite specifically the workplace as well and women of power in politics and in tech. But one of the big takeaways for me was how, and this comes to what you were just saying, Kamala, the language around a man who's stressed in a workplace is attributed to the job and to the work, and to a woman it's almost always attributed to their personality and their personal life. And I just had not probably ever really thought of that. And I think back over a career of working and go, yeah, actually, that's, and maybe when I was younger, I maybe even did it. You know, and said it, and it's been so eye-opening anyway. And it was interesting to have read that and be reading Startup Wife, and, you know, I know they're very different, but there's a little bit of crossover there. And as Kamala said, it is funny as well, this book, it's brilliant. And you had a lot of fun doing it as well, because I think I'm right in saying you actually imagined, like, loads of far-fetched ideas for this, and even a friend went to the trouble of creating a fake website. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I still use it to fake people out and pretend that all these startups exist. It was enormously fun.
It's a brilliant website. I think you better give them.
Yeah, what is it? We all want to know. Yeah. What is it?
I think it's utopiacollective.ai. So the novel takes place in a co-working space called Utopia, which is a place that is kind of imagining technological solutions for the post-apocalyptic world, which before I wrote it, we hadn't actually had a pandemic and a natural apocalypse. And it really does feel like the world that we grew up in no longer exists. That sense of, you know, there's going to be a Benazir. And I think in your book, that hinge, that moment when she comes into power, but then when you meet them years later and she's dead, is such an incredible reflection of how we all feel, which is that we grew up kind of through this moment, climbing to the top of this mountain, thinking, oh, we have the Benazirs, or even we have the Obamas of the world. Mm.
Yes.
And now it really feels like that's not going to happen again in our lifetimes, that sense of protean possibility.
I want you to talk about a couple of the companies you invented for it, because they're brilliant.
Oh, gosh. Well, there's one where a guy, there's actually a real, all of startups are based on real things. So there is a tick, it's called the Lone Star tick. And if it bites you, you can no longer eat meat. It's true. It's a real thing. And so he decides that it's going to be his mission to get everyone to be bitten by this tick so that we can stop eating meat and therefore save the world. So that's one of them. The other one is a woman who decides, you know, makes an app where you have to pre-agree to any kind of sexual activity before you engage in it. So you touch, it's an image, and you touch the parts of the body that you are willing to be. And then you sign, you have a contract.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about our anxieties about consent and sexuality. So, yeah, I mean, it was fun and kind of lighthearted and a way of talking about some of our concerns about the world that we're passing on.
And a friend of mine introduced me to some new social media platform the other day. And when I say introduced me, told me about it. It's called Be Real. And when they were talking about it, I literally thought they were joking. And I was laughing.
It's real.
Oh, it's real. Yes.
What is it?
It's Be Real. It's the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard in my life.
What is it? What is it?
Now, Tamima will tell me if I'm getting this wrong. But as I understand it, you sign up to it. It's an app. So you sign in. And every day, at a particular point of the day, could be any time, you get this, like, notification. Everyone who's on it gets a notification. And you have to take a photo there and then of what's happening in your life. And you take a photo from the front bit of your phone camera and the back bit, i.e. a selfie of you and what's in front of you. Right. And the idea being, I believe, that, you know, it's everyone's just being real, yeah? We're just, like, in the moment.
Right.
Rather than our jazzed-up Instagram.
And you're not allowed to use filters.
No, I think it's just like, you know, okay. Boom, you've had your notification. There's a time limit. Take the photo. It gets uploaded. And I just find the whole thing fucking ludicrous. I'm sorry, but it's like, why is people's energy being put into something like this? I can't understand it.
Well, I think people want to participate in ritualistic behavior. Right. And so everybody doing the same thing at the same time,
right,
or doing something that's countercultural where they're being unfiltered or they're being real. But we're using the same forms of technology that are making us feel that our lives are empty in order to sort of add meaning to our lives. So it's
you see, yes. This is why the book is so good, is that, you know, you just say be real and she gives you this.
I know. This is amazing. Yeah. We can just keep. I know. This is wonderful. I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading and enjoying recently, if there's some new authors that you've discovered that you want to give a shout out to, or just picked up, you know, a book recently. It could be ancient that you've loved. Have you found any time to read recently?
I recently reread some of the short stories from Lucia Berlin's collection, A Manual for Cleaning Women.
Oh, yeah.
And I just found them so dark. And yet there was this thread of, like, joy in the writing. People in kind of situations that are, you know, full of despair, poverty written about in such a kind of clear and precise, and yet somehow finding these moments of humanity. So I've really been enjoying those again.
Fantastic. What about you, Helen?
I am almost done with reading this really wonderful collection of essays. And I usually just go to fiction. I don't read that much nonfiction. But it's called How We Read Now by Elaine, either Castillo or Castillo. I'm not sure how she pronounced it. Have you read this?
No.
It's really wonderful. And one thing's, you know, it's one of those books that you read and you think, oh, you're just, you know, there's this thing I've been doing for years and you're just pointing out why I'm a total idiot. and it is about reading. And it's about her own relationship to books. And she does talk about something which I've sort of talked about on and off much less eloquently, which is when you grew up reading books and you were the unexpected reader of them or the unintended reader, you know. I mean, when I was growing up in Pakistan, reading books in English, you know, when people say things like, you know, who is your audience? And I always say I was never anyone's audience in a sort of demographic sense. I was their audience in as much as I was the reader who loved the book.
Yeah.
But this thing of, you know, what it is to be the unintended reader and also the weirdness of it. I mean, I remember growing up and I loved the C.S. Lewis, the Narnia books. And yet there were these odd moments where, you know, the villains in something like, you know, The Horse and His Boy were these dark-skinned men with turbans and curved scimitars. And you're thinking, oh, what's
going on? That
would
be me.
What's going on here? You know, and so she talks about that. But she also, the thing that I loved, which was, for years, when people talk about the novel and the value of it, I said, well, you know, novels create empathy. And she just skewers this so brilliantly. And sort of the point is, of course, that, you know, if you have to read a 400-page novel about someone in living in the middle of a war, you know, in Bangladesh, if you have to read a 400-page novel to feel empathy for someone living through the war, there is something wrong with you. but more than that, it's sort of, you know, writers from certain parts of the world, we get read for things like empathy. Mm. It's as though we are here to create empathy in you. We are here, and you being the white reader, you know, that we are here to help you understand something about the world. We will deliver up oppression and poverty and marginalization, and this is our role. And that word empathy is nestled so deeply in all of this kind of thing. And she just so brilliantly skewers that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So that's How We Read Now.
Yeah.
And the other one was A Manual for Cleaning Women.
That's
both
right.
Fantastic choices. Yeah. Thank you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And it's time for another recommendation now, because it's time for the Book Off, where each of you gets 3 minutes uninterrupted to tell us about a book you love that you think we should all read. Got to do a bit of admin just before we get into it. We always allow the person who's travelled the furthest to decide if they go first or second. Now, I believe that's probably, could be wrong, you, Tamima.
How is it you?
I think it's a toss-up. It could be either of us.
Is it? Go on. What are you saying? Well, where have you come from?
I've come from St. John's Wood.
St. John's Wood.
I've come from Gospel Oak.
I think she's closer.
I took the 214 bus.
It doesn't matter how you do it.
I had to change tubes.
You go first.
Okay.
Go on then.
All right, so you get to choose if you go first or second.
Oh, okay.
Oh. I'm going first in the hope that Tamima will say, yes, you're right. Forget
which means,
my book.
Tamima, you get to choose which of these rings you out or honks you out. So you can have the horn at the 3 minute
mark. No, I'm going first.
Yes, you're
yes,
going
you
first.
Will.
Oh, yes. Oh, so but she gets to
You've got to.
Oh, I see.
Chose it. You have chosen that you go first. Right. That means you get to choose which one of these is ringing you out or honking you
both
out.
Both of us.
And it's going to ring both
we
of us.
We can't do
out.
Like a honk and a ring.
No, you. You.
Jeez.
Wow.
I told you there was a lot of admin.
You're making a choice for me here.
I
can
am.
We hear both of them?
You
please?
Certainly may. Yes, of course. So let's do it in. Yeah, give it its proper gravitas.
Yes.
So it's either for you, or it's
I'm going to go with the bell.
That's a school bell. That's sort of recess
exactly.
time. Stop working
Time's
and run
up.
Out and play.
So you'll be having the school bell. You'll be having the horn. Okay?
Right.
And
okay.
just before we set the timer of the 3 minutes, tell us the book that you're putting forward.
Am I going to see the timer or are you going to hide
that
from
no,
me?
I never show. Don't
really?
Show you. Oh, no.
Oh, God. This is nerve-wracking. Have you prepared a 3 minute thing?
No, I haven't.
Okay. All right. Okay.
It's more fun if you go over and I have to, you know, honk you out.
Cut me off.
Yeah.
All right.
Which book are you putting forward?
I'm putting forward In the Skin of a Lion by Michael Ondaatje.
Fantastic. All right. 3 minutes then, on the clock, uninterrupted if you want it, to tell us about In the Skin of a Lion.
So this is a novel which I own about 4 copies of. I have one in my family home in Karachi. I have about 3 in my bookshelf in London, and I have 1 on the Kindle app on my iPad, so I'm never without it. And if you actually go online and look up a description of the book, what you'll find is people saying, this is a novel about the immigrants who built Toronto in the early 1900s, but whose stories were never told, which is sort of the opposite of, I mean, it's true. It is true. It is about that, but it sounds very sort of serious. Mm. And actually, it is a book of enormous fun and joy. It has nuns and actors and dynamiters and thieves. Our central character, Patrick Lewis, we meet him first as a child, but later when we meet him as an adult, he's a searcher. And a searcher is really someone who goes searching for people who are wanted by the police so that they can get a reward. And he's searching for a man called Ambrose Small. And instead, he meets Ambrose Small's lover and falls in love with her. And you might think, oh God, you could see Humphrey Bogart playing this role. And you very much get the feeling that Michael Ondaatje has watched those old movies which have Humphrey Bogart, which have the hard-boiled detective. They've got the gentleman thief who needs no weapon because he's got his wits, and he's read, you know, he's got these movies of escapades and cowboy westerns. But he brings that sort of blot fun and propulsion, but he takes out every cliche and stereotype and predictability and does it in language that is more vivid and beautiful and just exquisite than anyone else does. And there is great fun in it. There are a series of characters who you love and who all know Patrick. There are the two women he loves at different points. He writes romance really well, and I say that about few men, because the women are real and interesting and wonderful. It is absolutely heartbreaking in moments. Sometimes I reread it and get to the heartbreaking point and just stop because I can't go any further. But it's also joyful, and there's this one scene I'm just going to talk about to give you a sense of what it is to be inside this novel. Patrick is in prison with two men who he's befriended, and Patrick and one of his friends have been given the task while in prison of coming on the yard. Everyone's in the yard. They have to paint the roof blue. And they paint the roof, but they also paint their friend Caravaggio. And when everyone else has to go back in, when the prison horn sounds, Caravaggio lies down on the roof, climbs up, lies down the roof. And because he's the blue of it, he disappears into it. And then he can escape. And these are the kinds of really brilliant set pieces that are in it. It is fun. It is thoughtful. It is moving. It is also a great meditation on the relationship of power to powerlessness and the lives of immigrants, and it's fantastic.
Oh, that was, I'll give it a proper honk there. Sorry, I was just so impressed. And look, 4 seconds to go.
Well, there you go.
It's like you knew, or you could see my clock. But either way,
I might have beat at your clock.
after my big no, you'll never see the timer. Love that.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
We're going to come back and talk about it in more detail in just a moment. You can have a rest now. You can have a sip of coffee. Because the focus is on you now, Tamima. And before we set the clock going, just tell us the book that you're putting forward, please.
I've chosen Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu.
Now then. Okay. Now then, I've got a lot to say about Charles Yu, who was a guest of this very podcast.
Was he now?
Yes. Okay. But I'm not going to say anything now.
Okay.
This is a neutral space. 3 minutes on the clock to tell us about Interior Chinatown. Over to you.
The book I'm recommending is Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu, a book that I've recently come to, but I absolutely adore. It's the story of Willis Wu, a small-time actor who's always relegated to the role of generic Asian man in Hollywood films and TV shows. The author creates the fictional world of Interior Chinatown, a set consisting of a tenement building on top of a Chinese restaurant where all the characters are playing similarly small roles. Generic Asian woman, dead Asian guy, old Asian guy, etc. But these actors are also Willis Wu's family, his father and mother and neighbors in the apartment building. The novel is written in the style of a screenplay. It's even written in American typewriter font, with scenes described at the beginning as int, you know, interior, Golden Palace after closing, for instance, and the dialogue is formatted in the middle of the page. I love this novel because it is an experiment in style that actually succeeds in deepening our understanding of the characters. It's about race and how Asian people have been on the margins of the conversation around American identity, not just on screen, but in real life. It's also about how our understanding of American culture is so deeply influenced by film and television. I remember growing up in Bangladesh, and we would have 1 hour of American TV a week. And for years, it was The Man from U.N.C.L.E., then it was MacGyver, and then, shockingly, it was Baywatch. These images of America do not include Kung Fu Guy being anything other than a bit part. And so Charles Yu is also making a comment on what it is like to live a life on the margins of your own story. He writes movingly about the way his parents age out of their small TV roles and sink into poverty. And every character stands in for something greater than themselves, something that TV, I have to say, sometimes does better than novels. You can take a stereotype and really make that stereotype nuanced and complex. And he brings that sort of that kind of idea into the novel. If it's okay, I'm going to read a small passage and let him speak for himself. It's a guy who's doing about to do karaoke. Maybe it's the dream of the open highway. He's singing Country Roads, okay? The romantic myth of the West. A reminder that these funny little Orientals have actually been Americans longer than you have. Know something about this country that you haven't yet figured out. If you don't believe it, go down to your local karaoke bar on a busy night. Wait until the third hour when the drunk frat boys and gastropub waitresses with headshots are all done with the Backstreet Boys and Alicia Keys, and locate the slightly older Asian businessman standing patiently in line for his turn, his face warmly rouged on Crown or Japanese lager. Oh, I've run out of time. I've missed the punchline.
Oh, no, no, go on, do it.
I think you
go
get on, it. It. Yeah, no, no, it's okay. It's just a few more lines. I mean, it's so good, but...
Go on. Okay. We need
just,
to pay
just for the two of you. How about that? When he steps up and starts slaying Country Roads, try not to laugh or wink knowingly or clap a little too hard, because by the time he gets to West Virginia, Mountain Mama, you're going to be singing along. And by the time he's done, you might understand why a 77-year-old guy from a tiny island in the Taiwan Strait who's been living in a foreign country for 2/3 of his life can nail a song, note perfect, about wanting to go home.
It needed to be finished. It needed to be finished.
I think you should declare this a tie, because these two books clearly need to be read together.
Yes.
Right.
I mean, obviously.
Yeah.
They're both absolutely fabulous books, but on top of that, two amazing pictures with them. In the Skin of the Lion, I love that you've got so many copies of it. I know that feeling of having the same book in different places and, you know, never being too far away from it in case, you know, worried that like one might go missing. Yeah. And you need it. I love the description of all these different characters, the fact that you've got these like thieves. I think you said dynamiters. What
yes.
a great word. And,
yeah.
And what a great profession. And obviously Patrick being a searcher as well. The sense of, you know, I can already get a sense of this novel from the fact that you said, oh, we think Michael's probably watched all those Humphrey Bogart films of the 40s and that's you know, influenced them. But it sounds fun as well as having a proper message. It sounds like it's a page turner. His beautiful language that you mentioned, that he writes these romance scenes. I mean, everything about it just sounds phenomenal.
It is phenomenal. And the other thing is, it's a very slim book. And that is
really?
The miracle of it. Because you hear me talking, you think this is a fat book.
Oh, I thought it was, I was going to be an epic.
No,
yeah.
I mean, it's like 230 pages, maybe. And that is, I mean, that's what I,
no
because
way.
It is so full of stuff and it's not sparsely written. So it, I mean, I read it partly in a kind of, I still don't understand after all the times I've read it, how he manages to do so much and have there be such a sense of expansiveness. Mm. And yet it is a concise novel, and so you
wow.
can slip it into a very slim purse and carry yeah. it around with you, which I'm sure is useful for you to know.
It's very useful for me to know. And as you say, I was imagining a huge
yeah.
500-600 pager there. And then interior Chinatown. I mean, I didn't say anything before, but Charles Yu was on a couple of series ago to talk about this book, and I said to him then, and still think, you know, when I got sent it, I was just blown away by how different, like, just, you said a sort of experiment in style, and it really is. And so often that can not work, or you can kind of read it and enjoy it and go, yeah, I see what they were trying to do. Whereas everything you were saying in this pitch, and what I know from having read it, is he does do it. And he makes you think as well in a way that I don't think I ever have about America, about being an American, about the way that they do view Asians who've been born there, but they still sort of have to talk about them as being Asian Americans and on this sort of periphery of society. But the way that he also talks about, as I recall, the entertainment industry, the way that he actually shines a light on Hollywood, I suppose, is just brilliant. Because he's a screenwriter, and he's written a couple of screenplays himself, I think.
Yeah, he writes for Westworld. And you can definitely see that sense of these multiple realities existing in the novel as well. Mm. I mean, I think fundamentally he's talking about otherness and that sense of invisibility, but also of being stereotyped in very similar ways throughout the generation. So his father was, you know, the generic Asian guy, and then he became the old Asian guy.
Yes.
And he's the generic Asian guy who knows he's going to remain in this kind of invisible, yet deep, you know, a person who is invisible, but upon whom stereotypes are being projected all the time.
It's a great book. And that's another slim book as well. You can race through it. And yeah, that screenplay style, oh, everything. I adored it. And I loved your pitch for it as well. And it's so nice to be talking about that book again. And of anyone listening who hasn't heard the Charles Yu episode that was also with Makoma Wangugi, it's available. If you want to go back and listen to him talk about Interior Chinatown. Yeah, you might like to go and find that as well, Tamir. I keep getting told off for doing draws, you see, because I get to the point where I'm like...
Why should you listen to people who tell you off? You know, they want a sort of world where there has to be a loser. I think reject that.
It's a draw.
Hey!
Not many people sway me. And you, you've got a power there.
I have a power. I try my best.
I probably couldn't have called that one. I think it's fair. And also because you're mates. You know what I mean? I'm going out to buy In the Skin of a Lion.
Excellent.
As soon as we finish this.
Excellent. Good.
So thank you both for those wonderful pitches and for recommending two wonderful books. And here are another two wonderful books that I'll recommend. The Startup Wife by Tamima Annam. It's out now. It's published by the fabulous Canongate. And The Best of Friends by Kamala Shamsi. Also out now, published by the fabulous Bloomsbury. Get yourself a copy of both of those and pass them around. What an absolute pleasure to spend this time with you both. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you. And thank you for having us together.
Yes, thank you for having
welcome.
Me on with The Best of Friends. Can I just say...
Very good.
Yeah,
well done.
Can I just say, and you can cut this out.
I won't.
This book always makes me think of the Doja Cat song. She my best friend, she a real bad bitch. So I would say that this song and this book, in my mind, will always be wedded.
Love that. What I want to happen now, obviously, in the edit of this is for someone to put that Doja Cat song just at the end.
Do have to drop it.
Let's see if it happens.
It's
how will we know? You know, maybe when we listen to the finished episodes,
we'll know.
We'll know. Yeah. Thank you both.
That my best friend. She a real bad bitch. Got her own money. She don't need no nigga on the dance floor. She had 2-3 drinks. Now she twerking. She throw it out and come back in.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.